morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Interop Radio. This is the online audio portion of the Interop community. The Interop community will come together face-to-face in Las Vegas, Nevada at Interop 2015, April 27th through May 1st, 2015, in the beautiful, glamorous Mandalay Bay Convention Center from scenic Las Vegas, Nevada. Now, for more information or to register for Interop Las Vegas, please go to www.interop.com, and when you register, be sure to use that promo code radio to get a hefty discount on your total Interop conference. Now, today, we're going to be talking about some things that are a little bit different than the topics you're seeing all over the networking news, because if you follow the networking news, you might be forgiven for thinking that the only thing that's of any importance today is SDN, software-defined networking. My guest today, Ethan Banks, certainly knows all about SDN, but the fact is that there's still an awful lot going on in the networking world that's defined by something besides software. Well, first, Ethan, welcome to Interop Radio.
Thanks, Curtis. It's nice to be here. Folks that follow me might know me as the co-host of the Packet Pushers podcast, which you can follow at packetpushers.net. I'm glad to chat with you today.
Well, we certainly do hope that everyone will subscribe to Packet Pushers. It's well worth doing if you care at all about networking topics. And, you know, let's start by my asking you, do you think my characterization is wrong? First of all, do you find when you look out at networking news that most people, at least most vendors today, really want to talk about SDN stuff?
Of course they do, because SDN is the new hotness. It's the thing that it's got vendors excited, something else that they can design new products and put something else out to market and makes investors and shareholders potentially happy, and there's a lot of startups in the space. And so, yeah, as far as news and media sorts of announcements, there's always something new to write about when it comes to software-defined networking. It's a very busy segment, and so, yep, lots and lots of press built around that.
Well, with all the press built around the software-defined networking, when I go out and I talk to engineers about what's actually being put in place in the field, the story's kind of different. You know, when I talk to people about what they're deploying, it seems like SDN is still there in the sandbox. What are you hearing? In your consultancy, is this something that you find people are leaping into SDN in production networks, or are you still seeing lots of interest but relatively little deployment?
It is very customer specific who's getting into SDN and who's not. And so if you look back at some of the early history of SDN and why it came to be and some of the problems it was trying to solve, it has a lot to do with folks that are at the cloud scale size network having complex data center issues that they wanted to fix. And so they've gotten very interested and excited about SDN. And then if you move over to service providers, they also have some interesting problems to solve where they need to bring complicated services to market very quickly. And SDN and closely related NFV, Network Functions Virtualization, are interesting to those folks because that helps them with those problems. But interestingly, cloud-scale networks and service provider networks, although they have huge dollar spends, on a percentage basis, it's a very tiny fraction of the number of networks that are out there. And so you get down to regular folks, if you will, who are doing network engineering. Do their businesses need software-defined networking right now? And, you know, it's not enough for those folks to have SDN as a framework, as a simple capability that lets them do something. They need something built on top of that that's sold as an entire solution. And so that's where some of the interest is coming in for those folks. As far as what people are actually putting in, not too much, really. I mean, there are, in the SDN space, there are people who are fiddling with the knobs and kicking the tires a little bit. Maybe they're doing some demos. You know, I was in a chat the other day with a consultant who's interested in big switch networks and maybe working with the big cloud fabric offering because they are considering reselling it to their customers because they see it as an interesting solution. There are some folks who work with HP networking, and they're working with some of the applications that ride across HP's SDN infrastructure. Most folks, they just need to get stuff from point A to point B. Maybe they're looking at automation as a way to improve their network capabilities, but I can't say it's really taking over the mid-market, if you will, by storm. Everyone's got a wait-and-see approach.
Well, what do you see out there being deployed? It seems to me in the things that I get across my desk, one of the terms that does seem to be hot and that does seem to be hitting the ground a little bit more is converged network. How does that jive with what you're seeing?
So I'll pick that up a notch and even say it's beyond just network convergence now, and we're seeing a movement towards hyperconvergence. And hyperconvergence goes beyond networking. It includes networking, but it's really a play for the data center, no matter what size data center. Where you buy compute, storage, and networking all in one integrated bundle, rack it up, and off you go. And players in this space would include Nutanix, for example. Nutanix, I'll raise them because they've gotten lots of media attention. And that's a hyperconvergence is a solution that people look at and they see a lot of immediate benefits from that. It's kind of an easy solution to sell. Rather than buying your bare metal servers and putting your own hypervisor on it and buying a storage array, and then you got to pub up the your hypervisor to the storage array and then buying some network components, you can reduce a lot of those spends and a lot of that individual pieces and parts and mix and match and get it down into one unified solution. So you end up with one throat to choke, more something closer to that single pane of glass. I almost choked when I said single pane of glass because everyone that's in IT knows there's no such thing as a single pane of glass. You have several single panes of glass is what you really get. But with a hyperconverged solution, you get a single pane of glass from that vendor. You get a solution that's known to work together. You can scale it up easier if you need to add capacity by just adding a new node to the cluster. And it's a little bit easier to buy, right? Because instead of buying all these different pieces and parts and putting quotes together and so on, you can reduce your SKU count of things that you've got to order quite a bit. So that sort of a sell is pretty easy. It's not just a cost reduction. It's really an operational. It simplifies your operations in your IT group. And so that is something that it seems to be getting a lot of traction. And Nutanix, again, kind of a meteoric rise with the popularity that they've got very quickly in the marketplace. So, again, hyperconvergence is a big deal. And just to fill in the blank on the networking stuff for those folks that know a bit about hyperconvergence, the networking there that comes out of those boxes, you're still plumbing it up to network switches of some kind. It's not like you don't have to have a network anymore. You still got to plumb it into your core. But again, it's easier to make those things happen. I know as a network guy working with some hyperconverged gear, it was pretty straightforward just to pull up some 10 gig interfaces and some 1 gig backups, and off we went. Wasn't a lot of magic to make it happen. It was very easy to work with the guys standing up the cluster there to make it go.
Well, let me ask a quick question, because when we've talked about SDN, as you say, the people who are in the cloud scale and some of the ISPs tend to be very interested in some of the solutions there. With the hyper-converged architectures that you're seeing, the sort of everything in a box that will fit into a rack, and then you plumb the rack into your central switches, are you finding that it's mainly larger enterprises who are trying to fill data centers with hyper-converged racks, or does this go all the way down to organizations that might only need one or two rack enclosures to get started? How low in the market does this go?
As small a buy as you might have. If you're a shop that's normally just got a few servers in a rack, you are probably a candidate for hyperconvergence. No, you don't have to be a huge player by any means. Rack enclosures that can be, you know, 3-4 U high, you get two of those and you got a 2-node cluster, and that's a way to start in some of the solutions. I think you're going to be advised to go maybe 3 or 4 to get maximum benefit out of the solution, but you do not have to have huge compute needs or huge data processing needs be thinking in terms of a rack at a time of compute to be able to take advantage of hyperconvergence. Anybody can look at this, and I think that's part of the magic here. Just like virtualization scales down to a single server running a hypervisor and you put virtual machines on it, you can have just a rack that's got servers in it and look at hyperconvergence as a way to consolidate servers and storage, and reduce your footprint, reduce your power consumption. There's so much power you can cram into these boxes these days that if whatever's sitting in your data center now is, say, getting to be 3, 4, 5 years old, you might be able to surprise yourself with the number of RUs you could reduce that to if you can step into a hyperconverged solution.
Well, I want to pursue this a little bit more, and I'd like to go off in two completely different directions, if you don't mind. The first is the people side of things. One of the things that I hear from more and more folks in the IT industry is that we're seeing the rise of the generalist, that a lot of companies are hiring an IT staff where each individual is expected to be able to do kind of whatever comes along. You know, they might have a little bit more knowledge in one area or another, but they're expected to have a broad set of knowledge. Is the hyperconvergence and hyperconverged architecture something that really plays into that, or in your experience, do you still need to sort of tag team in specialists to take full advantage of something like this?
Hyperconvergence certainly plays into that. I do believe there is value in or truth to the notion of the rise of the IT generalist. And that's not just tied to hyperconvergence, that's really tied across IT as a practice in general. And here's the thing. The more you know, the more able you are to understand all of the things a data center does to accomplish its major goal, which is to deliver applications. So it's not enough, in my opinion, if you're, say, a network engineer, to know just about networks and nothing else. It's not enough to be a storage professional and know about storage and nothing else. You know, et cetera. You really are more valuable to the team and you're more valuable to the business as a whole if you have a broader set of skills. So if you are a network, maybe networking is your specialty, but you also have a pretty good idea of how a multi-tiered web application works and you understand a bit about the HTTPS protocol and you know something about SSL engines and how they work and you got a pretty good handle on DNS, all of those things are going to play into better architecting a solution for the business that you're working for. Again, you might have the thing that you're the best at or your knowledge goes the most deeply on, but knowing all of those other things are going to be very helpful to you as well. So to bring that back around to hyperconvergence, well, sure, you've got all of these functions in one box. You've got bare metal x86 with CPU and memory and understanding bus architectures in there and how all of the data flows in and out of the network interfaces and in that chassis. Those are all key things. Also understanding the hypervisor that sits on top of it and the provisioning VMs, that's also a pretty key skill. And then understanding how to provision operating systems on top of that would also be useful because it all is riding on the one platform. Being able to tune that thing well is great. And it makes, again, it goes back to making you most valuable to your business. And again, I want to reiterate the point. We're seeing a shift in the part of IT shops, from thinking about infrastructure and individual little silos to really thinking about IT as, again, this engine that that delivers applications. Everybody in the shop should be thinking about application delivery, because that's really what it's all about. You know, our technology is awesome as it is, and as much as we like to just go in the data center and play with this stuff, it isn't there for its own sake. It's there to do a job and to deliver applications for the business. So when we think in those terms, then we're thinking along the lines of what the business needs us to be thinking about. And I think that's a real key.
In your answer there, you talked a lot about architecting a solution, architecting an application, and that gets a little bit into the next part of my question, and that is the cloud. I know that there are some of the vendors, some of the big vendors, say HP and Dell among them, that really want to start delivering solutions where you have a converged or hyper-converged rack that also easily connects to their public cloud solution. Are you finding that being able to properly and easily connect to a cloud provider is becoming part of the basic set of concerns and features in these hyper-converged solutions?
You know, I think the answer there is it depends. Like so many things in IT, it depends. You know, what is your use case for public cloud? It would be the question. Do you need your hyperconverged solution? I mean, let's presume that you're building out your hyperconverged, because you're going to offer private cloud to your enterprise, and your customers are going to be utilizing your compute resources in an automated way. They're going to come in, they're going to hit your portal, they're going to spin up whatever it is they need, and off they go. Not that you have to use hyperconvergence for that, but let's say you do. And then you're out of compute because you've just got so many processes running on the infrastructure that you did buy, you need more. Where are you going to get more? Are you going to buy more? Well, no, I only need more for certain times of the year because of the way our business works. Okay, and maybe you do want to offload that to public cloud. You know, you could do that. But then there are other shops that they're actually going in a different direction. They're not really going to be building hyperconverged infrastructure. They might be looking at outsourcing to the cloud completely. But then if you do that, what does that mean? Those are different flavors there. I mean, you can pull compute down from the cloud, or you can just outsource and do software as a service, you know, kind of different things. And so I'm meandering around not giving a straight answer, because there isn't one. It's very use case dependent and very business specific. Another issue with public cloud is still that of security. It's not a new concern that's being raised here, but some businesses are not comfortable working in public cloud environments. They can't, because of the nature of their data. And if that public cloud provider can't give them the security guarantees they're looking for, they are forced to keep it all in-house. So how's that for a non-answer, Curtis? I feel like I didn't do too well with that one for you.
Well, I think it was a very informative non-answer, and we appreciate that. That's kind of what we build things on here on the radio. So we're good. But the fact that you had to, as you say, meander a little bit, I think speaks to another issue, and that issue is how the IT group communicates with the rest of the business. I mean, we've been hearing for years how important it is that IT be a partner with the other business units, how important it is that they work with the business units, both in terms of getting funding and in terms of being able to add value to the business. And it sounds like, whether we're talking about SDN or hyperconvergence, there can be a real challenge in finding language that's understandable by the business units that's also correct and meaningful to the IT team. Is that something that you're hearing people say is an issue, or are a lot of teams just trying to sort of whistle past that particular graveyard and ignore the issue?
whistle past that particular graveyard. That is a morbid way to put it, but you make a great point. So this is an issue, certainly. It's been an issue for a long time. And specifically the difficulty IT has to communicate with the business. And part of this is cultural, right? I mean, you've got business people who are thinking in terms of sales volumes and numbers and people needing to get their work done so that they can produce the product that their end customers are consuming. You got IT people who just love IT because technology is awesome, and they aren't really thinking a whole lot about the business necessarily. They're just nerding out on servers and network switches and firewalls and the latest application that's doing the gee whiz thing that's pretty awesome and all the rest, and they just love that stuff. And so there's a lot of this is just a fundamental disconnect between those two points of view. And so, yes, that's an issue, and then but we really have evolved, beyond that, because what's happening is IT or technology, I guess, if you will, is evolving to a point where business languages, business policy is expected to dictate what IT is going to look like. I mean that in a more specific way, where you are defining a business policy that then is going to be pushed down into the technology infrastructure to enforce that policy in some way. So, for example, maybe you've got data that has to be highly secured in some way, regulatory compliant, let's say. Okay. So that data needs to be encrypted, and that data needs to be inspected by two different devices. And then how are you going to do that? Well, you could traffic engineer a solution and make sure the traffic is encrypted properly and flows through the devices it needs to flow through, maybe a firewall, maybe intrusion prevention, or maybe some other sort of inspection device. There's lots of ways to do that these days. Okay, that's great. But the thing that's changing here are these policy engines that businesses are expected to be able to use to write a policy that's going to push that down into the infrastructure. Well, where's the translator that's going to make that happen? You've got software developers writing policy engines that maybe don't speak business speak all that well. You've got technologists who are trying to understand the business process and maybe do some of that translation work. And really, this is what I'm getting around to. You've got to, as a technologist, be able to do things. One, you got to understand what businesses care about and the language that they speak, budgets and revenue and customer expectations and that kind of stuff. And then you've also got to be able to communicate how technology is going to meet that business need and then move that up the chain. Going back to an original point I made about culture, there's been almost a disdain on the part of some IT people for business people. Oh, geez, salespeople, what are they good for? Oh, gosh, accountants, they're just annoying me and harassing me about budgets and making me produce reports. I hate those people. What do they know? We got to get way beyond that sort of a mindset as technologists and work within the context of the business. I don't think the business has to learn how to speak geek. I don't think that's really the business. It's helpful if folks can have some basic understanding of technology, for sure. I don't think they've got to learn the nitty-gritty details, though. I do think IT's got to work the other way and really make the effort to understand business needs and then be able to say, okay, so we need to deliver on a certain amount of uptime because that is our customer expectation for this data center, the application that we serve out of this data center to our customer. Okay, business person, to get that sort of availability, we need to buy these things, whatever it is, some list of things, and not get mired down into the nitty-gritty of it's this many disk drives on a shelf and it's this many network switches plumbed in this way, but just say, we're eliminating single points of failure. Use simple language that folks can understand. It's going to cost this much to engineer this solution. This is the benefit we get. And if we don't do it, our risk is X. Put things in a context that business people understand. Business people work in a context of risk and reward and cost and benefit all the time. if we can articulate those things as IT people, as technologists, then there's good communication that's flowing there between IT and business, and things are much more likely to get done, not get second-guessed every time. Is that, am I making sense?
You are making, I think, a lot of sense, especially for anyone who has been part of that transaction between the IT department and one of the other business units. One of the things that you talk about, you know, in trying to provide value and communicate, leads to a question about one of the issues that in many parts of IT is a huge issue. The sales team, the marketing team, all of those folks with cloud available up on the application layer. For many companies, what's being called shadow IT is a huge deal, where all of a sudden you find that people have gone out and gotten some sort of cloud service to do jobs and you know have committed to making things happen, and often are causing data flows that were unanticipated by IT just because they're going and sort of willy-nilly connecting all these services out in the cloud. With things like the hyper-converged architectures, is networking still an area that is insulated from shadow IT, or does the availability of this all-in-one box that, you know, I've seen some that even come with applications pre-installed and configured, does that make it more likely that a business unit is going to go around you if they don't think you're listening to them?
Oh, boy, that's a loaded question. You know, shadow IT is still creating data flows on the network, right? And as you pointed out, unexpected data flows. And the thing that happens, I think some business stakeholders that go and consume these services sometimes forget that there's further integration that's got to be done, you know, for those services to be available. There might be an impact to internet connectivity, let's say, assuming those services are consumed over the internet. And so there's still a role for network people to play in this, certainly, because I've been involved in a Salesforce.com integration, for example. Okay, to make that happen, it wasn't just, hey, we bought a bunch of Salesforce.com, and off they went. That is how it started. The conversation was, we just bought Salesforce.com. Now it's, we need to actually integrate this with our internal financial systems and so on. There was more to the story to make it happen. Yes, it had the advantage of no matter where a salesperson was, they could, you know, from their laptop fire up a browser, not have to use a VPN service or anything, and then get into the, you know, the CRM engine. But we still had to do a lot of integration work to make that happen. There was still a role for all the technologists inside the company to play. I don't see that it ever really, you know, entirely goes away, and I don't see that hyperconvergence necessarily makes it disappear. It might make it seem easier. You know, but something we can't forget here is that technology breaks. If your hyperconverged solution isn't working right, someone's going to know how to troubleshoot that thing and, you know, work with the vendor to resolve the issues. It isn't a magic box, no matter how much we wish it was, that can just, you know, automatically work all the time and be perfect. It's never that simple. There's always a role for a technologist to play. Sometimes the focus changes a bit, but there's still things that we're going to need to do all the time.
Well, speaking of things to do all the time, I know that you have things to do, our listeners have things to do, and it's time for us to bring a close to this episode of Interop Radio. Before we do, though, Ethan, can you tell everyone, I know you're speaking at Interop 2015 out in Las Vegas. Can you tell us where you're going to be out there?
Yeah, I will be speaking, I'll be delivering a session called Building or Lessons Learned, Building Active Data Centers. I don't have my schedule up in front of me. I forget what day it is, to be honest. And I'll be interviewing a panel of folks about the future of IT, what do things look like in 2025. And I'll also be chatting with three interesting startups, you know, on the cutting edge of technology in the networking space, kind of a fireside chat style. So really looking forward to that.
We are looking forward to hearing all of those. And Ethan, we very much appreciate you being here. Can you also tell our guests, again, where they can follow you? I know that you've got the Packet Pushers podcast that they need to run out and make sure to subscribe to. How about on social media? Where can they find you there?
You can follow me on Twitter at EC Banks, and I blog about networking in detail, sometimes hands-on projects, sometimes analysis of the news and what's going on at ethancbanks.com.
Outstanding. Ethan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Curtis. I really enjoyed it.
And thanks to each and every one of you for listening. You know, Interop Radio is one of those things that we could not and would not do without you, our listener, because you're part of the Interop community, and that's really what it's all about. The community will come together face-to-face at Interop Las Vegas, taking place from April 27th through May 1st, 2015, at the beautiful Mandalay Bay Convention Center in scenic Las Vegas, Nevada. Now, for more information and to register, as a matter of fact, to go and find out what time Ethan will be speaking and leading the panels that he just described, go to www.interop.com. And when you do register, be sure to use the promo code RADIO to get the very best deal on your conference experience. Now, if you're enjoying Interop Radio, and we know you are, then you're certainly going to want to be here in just a little while for the next page out of the Hot Stage Diaries. I'm here broadcasting live from the Hot Stage Warehouse in Silicon Valley, where the Interop Net is being put together prior to being crated up and shipped to the Mandalay Bay Convention Center. We're doing a Hot Stage Diary every afternoon, pardon me, at 4 p.m. Pacific, that's 7 p.m. Eastern. To find out the URL for that, please follow me at KG4GWA on Twitter. You're going to get all of those URLs. Now, we appreciate you being with us. We hope that you will continue to be with us, and be sure to be back next week when we've got another great episode of Interop Radio, Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern. Well, for everyone at Interop and Interop Radio, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for listening. Hey, we'll see you in the Hot Stage Diary in just a little while.